Listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia.
You're listening to CJSF Radio Simon Fraser 90.1 FM.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional engineer, professional futurist, and sometimes occasional sessional instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. And this is a weekly show that looks at future trends and issues and important items that affect your daily life and will be affecting your life into the future. Welcome to the show. We're continuing our look at the book, The Mind of the CEO, which looks at the future of the corporation by Jeffrey E. Garton. Last show, we were looking at the chapter, A Vision Without Execution is an Hallucination. For Rebecca Mark, the vision may have been too grandiose and too reliant on many business and political factors coming together. On the other hand, she came from a culture, namely Enron, where she and others had been highly successful in mounting difficult mega projects, and she had every reason to believe that she could change the world again. I recall her words to Yale students when she came to New Haven in October of 1997. Quote, "We at Enron have a mentality of taking a good idea and putting some money behind it. You can't create that kind of environment without extraordinary sense of vision. We like to dream very big," she said. "We have a saying around Enron that we just don't like to create our own rules. We like to create our own game. We like to change the environment so radically that we force the rest of the industry to move towards what we were doing and to have to see the world in an entirely new way." My comment on this is that shortly after this, Enron was indicted on one of the greatest frauds that a corporation had committed. So the rank and file employees were not aware of what was going on at the top. So it's important that when you're working for a corporation or any organization, that you keep on top of what is going on at the executive level to make sure they're not going to screw you and you're going to end up unemployed. Back to the book. Uber, Thoman, and Mark all show that while vision is a prerequisite for being a great CEO, it is a failure to execute well that gets chief executives into trouble. Sometimes it's not enough speed. Sometimes it's too much of it. Sometimes it's failure to follow through. Sometimes it's not having the right people in the right places. Sometimes the trends go against you. Sometimes the vision may simply be too grand. As the record shows, even highly experienced and skilled CEOs can crash. In fact, we may be entering the era of execution as opposed to the era of vision. Brent Schindler of Fortune put it when he wrote, quote, "As exciting as the past 5 years have been, the next decade will mainly be one of painting by numbers, realizing the potential of broadband and wireless, beefing up the infrastructure, implementing the new networking-based entertainment, information and commerce services, and otherwise fulfilling what Bill Gates and Andy Grove and other techno-visionaries have already sketched out for us," unquote. Schindler then quotes Peter Drucker, quote, This is the third or fourth time in American history when we had all of this emphasis on the genius CEO. The last time was in the 1920s, and before that in the 1980s. That always is a sign of big economic transition. But it isn't going to last because the transition to the information economy has already happened. Perhaps so, but eras don't end so suddenly. For years to come, we will demand CEOs with bold visions and CEOs who can execute with great skill. Few will be able to fulfill our expectations for both at the same time. Chapter 6, Shareholders and Stakeholders. Quote, I look at shareholder value as the result of several things, said Unisys Chairman Lawrence Weinbach. To me, if you take care of your people, and your people then take care of your customers, your shareholders always win. The vision of the company is to increase shareholder value. And what I tell everyone here is shareholder value is the result of what we call a three-legged stool. If we get it right with customers, employees, and reputation, then shareholders win. If we get it wrong, they lose. I'm very mindful of shareholder value, but I don't look at it as a single reason I'm in business. I think of it as the reason of what we've been able to accomplish. Since the rise of national firms in the United States at the end of the 19th century, there have been two conflicting philosophies concerning the purpose of the corporation. One says that the sole role of a business organization is to enrich its shareholders. This idea has often been embraced by Anglo-Saxon countries, but rarely elsewhere. In the United States in particular, the shareholder emphasis reached a feverish pitch in the 1980s when swashbuckling leveraged buyout firms dismantled one company after another in an effort to unlock immediate shareholder value while giving scant attention to the fate of the company's employees or of surrounding communities. The contending theory about the purpose of the company takes a broader view, asserting that a corporation needs to concern itself not only with its shareholders, but also with other stakeholders who include customers, employees, suppliers, and even entire communities. This more holistic view has been especially prevalent in Europe and Japan for over a century. In the 1980s, for instance, Europe and Japan prided themselves on fostering a different kind of capitalism from that of the United States, one which was more inclusive, more stable, and more caring. Given the last years of extraordinary activity by an ever wider range of investors in the stock market, it would seem that shareholder capitalism ought to be more intense than ever. Not just in the United States, but in many countries where market philosophies have taken hold. You should think that CEOs would be totally obsessed with how the stock market rates them day to day, and that they would gear all their policies to this end. However, the actual picture is much more complex. Of course, increasing profitability and shareholder value constitute the major responsibility of any CEO. And they all realize that ultimately this is the standard against which they will be measured. What's important, however, is not whether creating value for shareholders is the ultimate goal, or how and over what period of time that objective can be achieved. While the shareholder-stakeholder controversy is an old one and is worth re-examining, because in the new economy the boundaries of commercial organizations are beginning to disappear. In the industrial age, a firm could be defined by its physical and human assets, the factories it owned and the people on the payroll, for example. A large number of old line companies were vertically integrated, that is, automobile companies, steel firms, and the like, owned their own sources of raw materials because they found it more efficient than to buy supplies from third parties. Today, however, companies are no longer relatively self-contained organizations. They specialize in what they do best and either outsource the rest or create alliances and partnerships with other companies to handle all the non-critical activities they once did in-house. Horizontal links are replacing vertical ones. As Jack Welch says, your back office should be someone else's front office, meaning that if another company specializes in something that you are doing only as a support activity, it is probably better. They're probably better at it than you are because that is their primary business. You should therefore subcontract to that company and devote your own resources to what you do best and where you add the most value. In this environment, the new business model looks more and more like an open network. It is a model based on the idea that a huge amount of interaction between a company and all of its constituencies will create the maximum value possible. For a CEO, moreover, keeping the company competitive entails not only a close association with various constituencies, but also managing their interaction in such a way that the company is more than the sum of its individual parts. For example, it is not enough just to get a precise reading on what a customer wants. You must also trigger a chain reaction down to the supply subcontractors so that the product is automatically assembled to the customer's requirements whenever the customer places an order. All along the way, employees should be learning how to get even closer to customers and further perfect the system of flawless customer tailoring and quick delivery. In this way, more value, more speed, lower cost, and enhanced sales and service is extracted at every stage of the process. A similar case can be made for integration with suppliers who need to work closely with producers to create the necessary innovations and efficiencies. The critical role of employees needs elaboration, but the importance of links to the community may at first appear remote from the company's objectives. Yet these ties are essential not only to retention of customers and employees, but also to the company's general reputation. The dilemma for a CEO is stark and possibly irresolvable. Creating value today rests on establishing strong links with a wide range of constituencies, which require taking a long-term view. Meanwhile, financial markets are more riveted on short-term results than ever. Investors have become merciless in their quarterly referendums on CEOs' performance. If we take a close look on how CEOs think about some of their constituencies, starting with customers, then we find that business has always been about customers. What's the point of creating a product or service if no one wants to buy it? But it is becoming harder than ever for companies to keep them. As regulatory and trade barriers have fallen around the world, many more companies have entered the game. For many industries, such as automobiles, aircrafts, and electronics, industry estimates show that there's a massive production overcapacity, sometimes by over 30%, which leads to too much supply searching and too little demand. Competition has been aggravated by the internet, which has greatly empowered customers by giving them access to more information about what they are purchasing, including the ability to easily compare prices. Customers have also come to expect more customized and efficient service, and online customers can switch brand loyalty with a click of a mouse. All this is true whether the customer is a retail customer or another business. The most successful executives see customers not just as people or organizations to sell to, but as sources of knowledge that are essential to a company's business. They can and should be partners in participating and anticipating the products and services that will be required in the future. Companies need their frank and continuous feedback in order to create, distribute, and service top-of-the-line customized products. In this sense, customers are the key to remaining competitive. The more intimate a company's relationship is with their customer, the better the sharing of knowledge. One CEO who's achieved phenomenal success by showing attention to his customers is Michael Dell. I met him in his company headquarters, a nondescript box building in Round Rock, Texas, just north of Austin. For most of my other interviews, I had been met in the reception area by someone from the CEO's office who escorted me to the executive suite. As I sat in Dell's vast lobby, marveling at the sense of space and the number of people, most of whom were very young, coming and going at a rapid pace, I was suddenly conscious of someone standing beside me. I looked up to see Dell himself, who had come out to get me, and we walked together to a small conference room on the periphery of this floor. Dell again began his career when, as a teenager, he learned to take apart an Apple computer and discovered that he could order the components and assemble the machine for much less than the Apple's sale price. In his first year of college at the University of Texas, which turned out to be his last year of formal education, he figured out that he could make computers to order by adding customized features and limiting the middleman by selling directly to purchasers, many of whom were his friends at first. It was to become a business model that thrived even more when e-commerce came along. As their business grew from a room in his dormitory to one selling $1 million worth of computers each day, in 1999, Dell was the top personal computer retailer on the web. Dell's mass customization became the new standard, both for manufacturing and for the provision of services to computer buyers. Michael Dell's starting point is finding precisely what the customer wants. He makes it exceedingly easy for someone to specify the type and specific features of the computer that they desire. Armed with this information, the company can deliver a custom-made product in record time. Dell's system allows the company to keep minimal inventories, and all human resources can be devoted to increasing the efficiency of the assembly and delivery of the customized made-to-order product. This kind of extreme customer orientation extends to after-sales service. The same kind of linkages extend from Dell to equipment suppliers, with joint teams working to make production and delivery of supplies cheaper and faster. Dell refers to the entire system as vertical integration. We try to get so close to the customer that the only thing closer would be a kind of mental telepathy, he told me with a smile. You think you want a computer, and it just shows up. Dell keeps referring to his customer-centric approach. Quote, you have a series of interactions with the customer, some online, some on the phone, some face-to-face, and they're all intertwined to create an optimal mix of mutual understanding between us and the customer. Even as internet communications became more widespread, the human element became even more and more important. Maybe less frequent, but more important because you can resolve the routine problems online and save the human communication for the tougher, more unique challenges that the customer has. The company now creates web pages specific to each customer to provide extensive information about the customer's order. It has also developed software that integrates Dell computer systems into a corporate client software system that when a company orders from Dell, not only is a chain reaction begun between Dell and its suppliers, but the customer's own systems, approvals, budgets, inventories, etc., swing into action too. Dell's computer also stays close to their customers even when working on the customer's premises. To illustrate this point, Dell described to me how the company services GE. Dell personnel are in the plans to ensure that the computers run smoothly. They aren't just making house calls, they actually work there. And while they're at it, they work with GE engineers to design the modifications to the systems that GE actually wants in its future.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you're listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenneri. We're now going to take a short break and listen to a very important public service announcement.
Thank you. Every year, countless people succumb to the temptation to purchase exotic animals like hedgehogs, lizards, monkeys, even tigers and bears to keep as pets. But life in captivity is often a death sentence for these animals, who may suffer from malnutrition, an improper environment, and the stress of confinement. For more information on this issue, visit the BCSPCA website at www.spca.bc.ca.
Welcome back. You're listening to CJSF, 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenari, professional futurist.
Welcome back. We are looking at the book, The Mind of the CEO, which is a book that examines the future of the corporation, by Jeffrey E. Garton. We're on this chapter, Shareholders and Stakeholders. As with Dell Computer Corporation, the line between FedEx and its customers is often not easy to identify. So great is the interaction and the intimacy. For companies like Apple Computer, Hewlett Packard, National Semiconductor, and Cisco Systems, FedEx coordinates the global supply chain, helping customers find components anywhere in the world, facilitating the assembly of finished products and delivering the product to the ultimate consumer. Fujitsu, the Japanese computer maker, is a good example. In the mid-1990s, it was losing out to competitors because customers had to wait 10 days between the time they ordered a laptop and the time it arrived at their door. Fujitsu then decided to turn over much of its computerized distribution system to FedEx. Today, FedEx flies in parts, its parts from Asia to its own warehouse in Memphis, where they are configured into laptops and shipped out the next day. Customer waiting time from the beginning to end is 5 days or less. FedEx orchestrates the entire process. FedEx has helped companies like National Semiconductor Corporation to reduce overall logistical costs as a percentage of revenues by some 30% in the 1990s. It realized that many companies who want to reduce inventory costs need to radically redesign their entire manufacturing processes, all the more so in a global economy. The company has therefore been training salespeople to be able to help clients do just that. Michael Armstrong is also preoccupied with building a customer-centric organization. Quote, "We're in the early stages of a communications revolution," he said. "But this revolution isn't about AT&T or any other of the companies trying to make it happen. This revolution is actually about customers. These days, you have to ask, what is the real value that you bring to the customer? You have to eliminate the processes and that have no value, the costs that add nothing to what is most useful to the customer. The paperwork, or the distribution, or the service system, or many of the other things you spend money on, you think they are of value to the customer, but they are not. And someone else who can supply the pure value without added costs will take your business away." He gave me an example. Today, when you get a phone bill, you get call detail. It tells you where you called, how long you were on the phone, and what originating number was, what the completion number is. Call detail costs us $250 million a year. We think of that as a service. It costs us $50 million to produce it. The costs of switches. It costs us $200 million to answer the phone on questions about it. If we put all that up on the web, which we have done, we'll give customers themselves the ability to sort through all that information the way they want it. How many times a month did I call Jeff Garton? All you have to do is hit the mouse and sorts it all out for you. or say instead of seeing it in chronological order, I'd rather see it sorted by states or in the order of the dollar amounts. So let's give people the ability themselves rather than paying the $200 million to staff for what I used to call wonderful service, when in fact it's really only an additional cost. Many CEOs, particularly in the technology business, believe that customer service is synonymous with providing a total solution to a customer's needs. As the complexity of various technologies has increased, customers need simple ways to use them and seamless ways to link them. As technology companies differentiate themselves, becoming ever more specialized, however, no firm can deliver them in-house resources, everything that a customer needs. Many corporations are therefore taking on the role of a solutions provider, that is, coordinating the work of several firms in order to deliver one product. Motorola is a good example. What our customers want are solutions to complex problems. Christopher Galvin explained this to me, quote, "They want the pieces of the communications puzzle and the software puzzles and the architectural puzzles to fit together to meet their needs. They don't really care about the uniqueness of the technology they use. They just want plain answers." So we restructured the company these past few years around this concept, a radical change from the old culture in which we prided ourselves on having the most unique technology. It's all about listening to what the customer wants, not just selling just what you have. And what people are saying is, quote, "I don't want to buy just the box from you. I want you to put the software in it. I want you to install it." They might even say, "Run the system for me, get the backup electricity organized, manage the technical people." And what we're saying is, "We'll get it all set up for you. We'll bring you the solution." So most customers wanted the internet on a wireless system. Someone has to build a handset for that screen on it. And the screen has to contain a micro browser. You then have to have someone organize a server and so forth. In the old days, we'd walk in and say, let me show you my handset. It's one of the niftiest one you can find. And the customer would buy it. And then he'd have to go somewhere else to get the software code written, and somewhere else to get the phone connection hooked up, and to someone else to integrate it into the rest of their communication system, and then someone else to test it. Now, one group can do all of that, often with partners or subcontractors like Cisco Systems, for example. We get the end-to-end solution done, is the conclusion. So we're going to be looking at this and further examples of how shareholders and stakeholders are being affected by the new corporation in future shows, so please stay tuned.
You have been listening to Future Talk on CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby, and Future Talk is a weekly show on important issues that affect you and your future. And this is Dr. Teneri, professional futurist, reminding you that if you're not willing to make the effort to invent your own future, then others will be only too happy to invent it for you. See you next week.
Listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia. Hello and welcome to Viewpoints. On this week's show, we've got happy stories from small town Canada lined up for you. Our first story will be about a local historian lobbying local council to establish an official village fungus, and she has an idea for a potential nominee.
I looked it up and nobody has an official fungus. Why can't we start a trend? For me, it was just a lighthearted way of acknowledging how special this community